Broadcasting live from the Business Radio X studios in Atlanta, Georgia, it's time for Atlanta Business Radio, spotlighting the city's best businesses and the people who lead them.
Lee Cantor here with Katie Galley, another episode of Atlanta Business Radio. And Katie, this is going to be a fun one.
Yep, it is.
You know that this is an important topic,
healthcare. Healthcare is always important.
And we got with us today, Sam Zamaripa with Intent Solutions. Welcome, Sam.
Good morning.
How bad did I butcher that last name?
That was perfect. It sounded like you were right off the bus from Mexico.
I don't know about that. So tell us a little bit about Intent Solutions. How are you serving folks?
Thanks for the question. Thanks for having me. Intent Solutions was founded now about 3.5 years ago, really based on a single story of one of our directors. This was an individual who had a successful career in the New York area. He had an automobile accident and broke his hip. Shortly thereafter, he was prescribed prescription opioids, oxycodone, as most people know. By his own admission, he thought if one was good, two was better, and three was even much better. And he became terribly addicted to opioids. The net result was devastating to his family, his career, and his life. Fast forward,
which is not an uncommon path for a lot of people in America nowadays.
Regardless of your stature in life, that's correct. And so he now is fully recovered, successfully. He's doing very, very well. But he had this idea that if he'd had some kind of technology that would have provided him a pill when he needed it, as prescribed, but restricted the access, that he might have avoided the addiction. That was a compelling story now to us about 4 years ago. And myself and my current chairman, Dr. Van Crisco, we listened to the story and we thought maybe there is a possibility that a technology could be invented. And based on that story, Intent Solutions came to life.
So you have a product that is a device that kind of helps the person manage their dosage, pills?
That's right. Think of a smart PEZ dispenser.
Right.
Yeah. Our technology is called TAD, for take as directed. It's about the size of a pack of cards, not very large. And the medications are contained inside the device. So you as a patient and user, you don't have access to them by just opening
the pharmacist
top.
Puts it in?
That's correct. It's filled by a pharmacist, especially pharma or corner drugstore.
And then I bring my device to them and they fill it, or they just give me a new device every time?
Lots of different ways to get it to you, including overnight shipping. But yes, effectively, once the device is empty and you bring it back, it is filled. It's programmed with a prescription that is by your doctor who authorizes it. And then your access will only be permitted via your biometric, your thumb or your fingerprint. Mm-hmm. It's a smart device, so it connects wirelessly to any kind of smartphone or tablet. So it lets you know when a medication is available. It reminds you. And then once you put your fingerprint on, it dispenses. You can then have your medication as directed.
So now... And then if this has to be mandatory in order for this to work this way, right? Like a person can't just get a hammer and break it and say, I'm out, to the pharmacist?
Yeah, but it's a great question. There's a lot of different circumstances that people are in who are taking prescription opioids. Some, they're only taking them for a short period for acute treatment, some
right.
longer for chronic pain. We're best on that front end of acute management, where you're getting your first prescription. You may have some concern that you don't want to be exposed to the medications. Maybe you don't want those medications in your household around your children. So our device gives you the ability to have those meds, which are important,
right?
Which provide an important function, but also only will dispense them as they're needed.
So now, is this specifically for opioids, or does this make sense for other drugs?
There are two principal sectors that we're focused on. One is the pain world, where there are prescription opioids, Schedule II narcotics. But the device is also very useful in clinical research for large pharmaceutical companies, where they're trying to prove the efficacy of a new medication. Mm-hmm. So our customer base is both pharmaceutical research and also, in broad terms, the pain industry.
So now, what stage are you at now?
So we're now in our fourth year. We have 12 employees. We're in Midtown. We're part of ATDC. We have now commercial product in.
So it's out in the wild.
It's out in the wild. We have customers, and we have more coming on every day. We're in the second iteration of the technology, and our customers today, we still consider them early. We're all learning because it's a fairly complicated platform. It is the dispenser itself.
Right.
There's an app. This device streams data. So this is a new frontier for people, both in the applied healthcare arena and also clinical research.
Now, is it a challenge for the older folks to use?
A lot of people see our technology. They see the TAD device and they say, "Hey, this would be great for my grandmother." That is not our target user. Our target user is someone who is on prescription medications. If they are elderly, oftentimes they're going to have a home health care provider, as in the hospice care, which is a very good use for us. But our device is more broadly used by even fairly young people.
Like the weekend warrior that blew out his knee.
That's right. That's exactly right. And who knows enough about the properties of these opioids to be concerned,
right,
and wants to have some way of governing their use.
So now, do you sell them? Is the customer the pharmaceutical people, or is the customer the pharmacy, the people that make the pills? Who is the customer?
We'd like all those to be the customers, but our principal customer today, we're a B2B organization, so we don't sell directly to consumers, and we don't sell the device itself. We are a services company. So if a customer comes to us and says, "Look, we have 100 people in a hospice setting, for instance, we'd like to have enough devices to cover those people for a year period," we give them a bid on that, and we guarantee the devices will always be available. If they're broken or lost, we replace them. We also make sure they're filled per the appropriate prescription. We have a working relationship with another large specialty pharma company. And then we also manage the data sets. So our customers are able to look and see what actually happened to their 100 patients over a period of time. They can see the adherence patterns.
Right, the exact amount of pills. This isn't a guess anymore.
It's not a guess. Think of us in some ways as a great accounting device.
Right.
A safety device and an accounting device.
So now the way that data is kind of being used, is this obviously plays into this because you're giving them exact numbers. This isn't a guess, like we said. It isn't guesses, or it's in a bottle in a...
Yeah, I think that question is an important question. In general, all of us think that we will take our medications as the doctor prescribes them.
But we don't.
We don't.
Right? Well, like, do you have stats on that? Like, what percentage of people take them?
Even about less than 50% of all medications are taken as directed.
Less than
50%. And
were you surprised when you heard that?
I was. I didn't know anything about adherence when we first started the company. I've now learned more than I care to know.
Right.
But let me just say this. Our general view is that adherence is not something that's real natural to us. Think about your own experience with learning to buckle your safety belt.
No, compliance. Humans aren't we're compliant.
It takes a long time. It took me a decade to finally...
We'll see how many tickets people are going to get for holding their cell phone now with the hands-free law in place.
Yeah, listen, I'm working on it. I'm working on it. And I think that, back to your question, so we think that we can generate data that does give our customer insights. You know, data, raw data is one thing, but it's what you learn from that data, the insights that you gain that make the difference, whether it's in a healthcare outcome or in protecting people's lives.
So now, what's some of the insights that you've been able to gather thus far?
It's too early. We are generating data. We are moving now with, at Georgia Tech, we have access to a great number of people who specialize in data sets. But here's the funny thing, Lee. In a few months from now, our small company is going to have more data on adherence than at least real dispensation data than most companies in the world.
In that short of a period of time?
Yeah, because it's thousands and thousands of pieces of information. We know when a person took it or if they did not take it. Our device even will capture if someone that was not authorized to use the device places their finger on the device. In addition to those things, our device measures temperature and humidity. So we might be able to know, for example, Lee, that on Saturday afternoon, your device was cooking at 90 degrees and you didn't take a single pill. But on Monday, 8 o'clock in the morning, bingo, you were on your program as was intended. So we're going to learn a lot about how people really behave. And let me just get down to the point of what that means. That's not about us being Big Brother. That's about you and your doctor having more information to say, you know, this is working for you. This doesn't look like it's working for you. We can adjust this. Let's work together on what will make your health better.
So now, speaking about as directed, like sometimes they say, take it twice a day or whatever, like in the morning and the evening. And you'll be able to say that, no, they didn't take it twice a day, or they took it at noon and at four.
Yeah, we've learned a lot about that particular set. And a lot of doctors have suggested to us, look, let's start with our patients with an open regimen. In other words, let's give them the device with no program in it and say, hey, Lee, we'd like you to take this no more than three times a day when you feel like you need it. Maybe
so
one.
It's my judgment.
It's your judgment. But then, you know, 10 days later, we get you back in and say, no, Lee, we noticed that you only took one a day, right? Were you feeling pretty good? How was that working?
Or you're only taking one a day at 3 o'clock.
That's right.
Is something happening at 3 o'clock that's
exactly right. So it gives the doctor more than just the memory of the patient or an anecdote to make better decisions. And doctors, you know, our finding is that doctors are excited about this kind of insight. Doctors in general are very concerned about understanding what really happens to a person. And we think we think the TAD device.
And this goes well beyond opioids, though.
Well beyond opioids. If you think about the opioid space, our device, TAD, is really about restricting access and making sure you don't misuse, abuse, or divert the drug. That's sort of the
right
thing. But in diabetes research or cardiac research, this is all about the relationship between your medication and a healthcare outcome.
Now, what about the fact that so many people are on multiple medications? Am I going to have to carry around 14 of your devices?
You know, it's funny. We made a decision about 24 months ago that we were going to specialize in a single med dispenser. There are other kinds of devices out there, very interesting technologies that do what's called polypharma. We think they're interesting. But because we have a single med, our device can stay in the supply chain. In other words, it can be at a pharmacy. It can be at a specialty pharma. It can be loaded there. It can be programmed and easily then forwarded on to the customer. When you have multiple pills, that's a different kind of problem to address. Yeah, I suppose there are circumstances where people will have two of our devices. But believe it or not, the single pill market, both in the opioid space and in clinical research, is so large that we feel like we can make a very substantial business there.
Now, how do you see kind of healthcare evolving? Are you seeing other companies getting involved in the healthcare arena, like maybe non-traditional ones?
Yeah. I mean, I think for the world, I think the IoT world, you know, the Internet of Things world, which has been driven by communications technologies, phone apps, et cetera, and the advancements in low-powered Bluetooth have allowed a lot of connectivity, a very reliable connectivity and mobility that previously wasn't in the market. So I think you're going to see a lot of companies move in utilizing those kinds of technologies, advanced microtechnologies, you know, even variations of AI to bring devices to the market that assist people in managing their health.
In terms of just compliance, abuse of medicines, or
all over the place. Yes, in compliance and abuse. I think, for instance, back to our niche, which is about adherence and misuse and abuse, I think we're in the very early stages of understanding that probably, Lee, we should have never had an open bottle. We're going to look back, you know, in about a decade and say, you know,
that probably wasn't the best idea.
That was not the best idea. It was like driving the car without the safety belt, right? It was that period of time. And I think from that, on the healthcare side, practitioners, technologists, policymakers are going to be thinking about, okay, well, what kind of packaging, smart packaging, do we need to protect people and also promote outcomes?
Right. So this goes into then kind of maybe a mental shift in using the term smart packaging, where it's kind of protecting the customer from themselves.
That's right. And we have to protect ourselves from ourselves. We can't overeat. We can't drive too fast. And neither can we take medications that are not good for us.
You need to put that on chips because you should see Katie and her chips every day. Show them your chips. Can you make a device for this?
Yeah. Katie, that's called do not go shopping this time of morning. But, you know, back to your point, our slogan is called Advancing Take as Directed. We think the Take as Directed mantra is a good one. It's loaded with, you know, sort of an admonition that you ought to take.
Well, it's kind of very libertarian. And, you know, hey, take it as you see fit. You know, this is on you now, but be responsible. But, you know.
And we think the next advancement of that is to raise the questions that you're raising, which is, what is good for me? How does that work? What should I have access to and what should I not have access to?
But you see how quickly it changes, though. Like, even the guy that was one of the starters of the company where for him, taking it multiple times a day, you know, maybe having multiple prescriptions in different doctors, that was what he was needed, you know, to get through the days.
You know, I think everybody understands this notion that we all consume a little bit more than we should. And in that may be fine with potato chips. You may have to work out a little harder, but it is not fine with prescription opioids.
Right. So now let's talk about a little of your backstory. Before the show, you mentioned you weren't always in this arena.
No, I've been a generalist entrepreneur for my career. I've had a successful career both on the investment side.
Is that where you started?
I started as basically a senior chief of staff for a very high level executive.
Like right out of college?
No. Right out of college, I was an aide to a governor.
So you were in politics?
I was a policy person. Uh-huh. I have a master's degree in public policy from Syracuse University, where I've served as a trustee in the last decade. But I had an interest in policy. I migrated, became an aide to Andrew Young, someone who's well known in Atlanta, through the early Olympic period. And during that era, I met some of Atlanta's most extraordinary.
Is that what got you to Atlanta?
No, I came much earlier. I came to work for a governor named George Busby back in the late 70s.
So politics took you to Georgia?
Politics brought me, policy brought me to Georgia. And then through the world of...
Do you have policy and politics in your mind are separate things?
They are. Yeah. I was a politician as well. I was an elected official. But in terms of policy, that's a literary form of thinking about the nature of government in our lives. And I worked in that arena. And I'm still a consumer of that, but especially in healthcare. But that was long ago.
But educate me about the difference of policy and policymaking and then how it kind of gets placed into the sausage machine of politics in order for then something to help a citizen.
Ultimately, policy is a wrestling match between an ideological view and a fact base. A good policymaker is aware that that politics or ideology is always an underpinning. You know, we're going through the choice of a Supreme Court justice today, and everybody's second-guessing his ideology. How will he make decisions? And that gets down to very personal philosophies of life, of human behavior, et cetera, et cetera. But on the other side are facts. You know, what does work? How fast can a car go before it becomes dangerous?
Right.
You know, how much road capacity do we need here in order to serve the people of Atlanta? How much public policy do we need around opioids to reduce the death rate that is out there today? So it's a wrestling match between an ideological perspective, a philosophical view of life, and the facts that are out there. And I think that's healthy and that's good. There's nothing wrong with that. We are not perfect with it, but a good policy person is aware of that.
So now, does a policy person, are they agnostic when it comes to the different parties? Are they just trying to come up with good policy that helps humanity, or are they kind of having to kind of work through an agenda of the party that they're working with?
Well, I think it varies. I mean, as in my world, I'm a pragmatist, and I try to move things forward. You know, progress is really one of the larger objectives of any policy person. How can we make progress? What are the sequence of events that we have to go through to get there. So I think some policy people are absolutely partisan, but my perfected policy people are just people who do a great job in earnest of trying to blend ideology and facts together.
Now, what about the speed of which change takes place? Now, it's my understanding, and I'm not, don't know anything about this, just other than my kind of gut understanding, that things were put in place to make things move slowly.
Yeah, I think that
the people today, because of technology a lot, they expect things to happen fast.
Yes. Yeah.
You could make mistakes by changing kind of core ways of doing business in politics that make things go fast, and you might get some unintended consequences.
Yeah. And that's the dilemma between the idea that life is instant grits and things happen that shouldn't happen. And so I think government does move slowly, and that's probably,
but that's by design.
And that's not a bad thing, because you think about the collective investment that's made state level, county level, et cetera. In my view, you should be slow. Now, that doesn't say you shouldn't have a very, very structured commitment to innovation and to doing the best and most current things. Mm-hmm. And so, for example, in our space, you know, we are very much interested in collaborating with the agencies that regulate us, the FDA.
Right.
Because we see the FDA being very interested in the progress and the rate of change around how to combat the opioid crisis. So that's a really good example, I think, of the FDA. The FDA has recently stepped up. They've announced that they're going to do some innovative procedural work, regulatory work in advancing technologies in our space. We're going to participate in that. And that's very unusual, because a lot of companies of our size, they're a little bit intimidated by the FDA from a regulatory perspective, because we're business people. But it's in our best interest to collaborate with them, because they're interested in innovation. And right. that's what we're committed to.
And then I guess your unique background, this is where this can bear fruit, because you already have a mindset of working with them and collaborating.
I hope so. We have been effective in working with the Georgia delegation. And I would encourage all entrepreneurs to think about their elected officials as partners in what they're trying to accomplish, especially in healthcare. Because it is so complicated, so expensive, and slow, so difficult to change. But we've worked with Senator Isaacson, who has been terrific. We've worked with Congressman Buddy Carter out of Savannah. You know, he's the only pharmacist in the United States Congress.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and so Congressman Carter absolutely understands what we're doing with our technology.
It's right in his... It probably touches a nerve.
It does. In fact, we think he's going to be in Atlanta on August the 22nd at Georgia Tech, and coming there to talk with other entrepreneurs about what they're doing. So my point here is that it is absolutely a good use of time for entrepreneurs to engage with elected officials. These people that have succeeded at the United States Congress level or the United States Senate, they're very capable people, and they understand business. And in terms of Georgia, they want to promote Georgia entrepreneurs. So we've had a very effective relationship there.
Now, also, you're an author. Can you talk about how that came into play? You got a lot on your plate.
You know, I was early in my life. I was also a writer. I abandoned it to work on my professional career and to have my family, which I have a wonderful family. But I came back to it about a decade ago with the idea that I wanted to spend more time perfecting the discipline of becoming a writer. So over almost 7-8 years, I produced 2 novels. They're both out now. But I'll tell you why I think this is a relevant discussion. I am a CEO. I run a company. We plan every day. We have finances. We have people. We communicate. And I think being a writer has made me a better CEO, because I think it makes me focus on how I think, how I structure communications, the discipline of writing, and just also my own time management. You know, I write early in the morning, but as soon as I'm finished writing in the morning with my right brain, you know,
I turn it off.
I get to the company, have my left brain on, and the two do not intersect. But I think it's made me personally, I feel very fulfilled doing both, and I think I will do it. I'm on my third novel now, which may be out sometime in 19, and if I work at it right.
Now, what's your writing routine?
I'm a 5 a.m. Every day writer.
Do you have a word count or?
No, I don't do that. And if you read about writers and their styles, they all have different approaches. I tend to follow what I call the John Fowles rule. John Fowles was a great English writer. The French Lieutenant Swimman, The Magus are two of his large books. I follow the rule that you get up and you just try to engage with the feel, the emotion, the sensibility of what you were trying to write and see what happens. And if it takes off, just go with it for as long as you possibly can. And that's not predictable because it doesn't take off. Sometimes you start at the wrong place. And if you do, you just have to tear it up, start over.
Do you map out the story, like storyboard the story? Do you know how it's going to end, or do you let the story write itself as it goes?
A little bit of both. I think not including myself in this company, but great writers do both. They have a story to tell that has a beginning and an end, but they also have this firm belief in the powers of how characters and scenes really do self-populate. Because once a character has been created in a book, and that character speaks in a certain way, walks in a certain way,
and would do certain things that wouldn't do certain things.
That character then becomes alive, and so authors and me included, you know, we live with our books. They are alive, and so they do self-populate. But you also have a discipline of the beginning and end, and I'm probably guilty of not being the best storyteller, but having let my characters take over from time to time.
And what type of books? They're fiction?
Yeah, I write fiction. I write it's a literary fiction. Some would call it speculative fiction or cross-genre. I like to think of it as a contemporary magical realism.
Mm-hmm. And then are they the same characters in each book, or is each book kind of self?
First two books are series, so yes, there are the same characters. The third book, a different
totally
story,
different
place, yeah, different time.
Good stuff. So doing a little of everything. Are you still have your investment firm?
I have assets from that period of time.
Or you're all in on Intense Solutions?
Well, I'm all in. My
and
life
your
is
books.
Yeah,
those are your two all-ins.
Yeah, all in. All I serve on some company boards, and for entrepreneurs, I think all that's important. I'm a board member with a terrific entrepreneur, well known in Georgia by the name of Guy Milner. I've been a director for his insurance company for more than a decade. It's a terrific company. I've learned a tremendous amount from him. And I would say to entrepreneurs, there's no substitute for being a director with a tremendous business leader and learning some of their skills. And
sure.
I've done that. And that's the other thing I do on some time.
And then right now, what do you need more of?
The automatic answer is money, but it's not really money that at this stage of a company that makes a difference. It's the right people. It's the right people in the right seat. And there's not an absence of that in Georgia. We're around Georgia Tech, so we're just surrounded.
A lot of smart people.
Well, they're coming from Emory, they're coming from State, they're coming from Kennesaw, they're coming from all the universities, they're coming from out of state. So we always need to make good decisions about who we bring on. The worst thing that I experience as an entrepreneur is having, if I make the wrong choice. Because what I've effectively done is I've put someone in a position that wasn't right for them. So in a sense, I'm doing them a disservice.
And the firm.
And the firm. So my job is to make sure it's the right person, right seat. And if the right people in the right seat doing the right things and the company is growing, then the money and the value will follow.
Are you looking for more partnerships in terms of pharmaceutical companies?
My partner, Ashley Hancock, who is one of the founders, is out there all the time working on that. ATDC does a good job of expanding that network for us, but we are in discussions with multiple clinical research organizations, pharmaceutical companies.
Pharmacies themselves?
With the larger ones, yeah. We're talking about supply chain and how this works. I think in a relatively short amount of time, even though TAD is only a B2B device today, I think sometime in the next few years, you're going to see it take a commercial form. You may be able to acquire, use it at a Walgreens or a CVS or an independent pharmacy.
All right. Intent Solutions, the best way to reach you guys, a website?
That's right. www.intentsolutions.com in Midtown, Georgia.
Well, Sam, thank you so much for sharing your story today.
Thanks for having me here, and don't eat too many potato chips.
All right. This is Lee Cantor for Katie Galley. We will see you all next time on Atlanta Business Radio.